The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, case 16, the bell sound in the priest's robe. The main case. Master Yunmen said, "Look, this world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your priest's robe at the sound of the bell?" Woman's commentary. Now, in studying Zen and disciplining oneself in Zen, one must strictly avoid following sounds and clinging to forms. Even though one may be enlightened by hearing a sound or have one's mind clarified by seeing a form, this is just a matter of course. It's nothing to talk about if a Zen person is able to master sounds and control forms and thus can clearly see the reality of everything and is wonderfully free in everything they do. Though it may be so, you tell me, does a sound come to your ear or does your ear go to the sound? Even if you're able to transcend both sound and silence, how could you speak of it? If you listen with your ear, you cannot truly get it. When you hear with your eye, then you can really know. The poem. If you understand it, all things are one. If you do not, then they're different and separate. If you do not understand it, all things are one. If you do, they're different and separate. So as Shoen mentioned, we've been doing an introductory retreat this weekend. So this is a koan, and a koan is a very profound contribution to the body of not only spiritual religious teachings, but of practices, a kind of gift to the world. So here we have a statement by Master Yunmen that he gave live one day to his students, a question, a living thing. And as it becomes a koan, so in that moment, you can imagine Master Yunmen, who was a very well-known, very powerful teacher in the 9th century, early 10th century China. And just imagine yourself there, and what would you have done? What happens now in your mind? What do you do with that question? Of course, he was speaking to a hall of monastics who, at the sound of the densho, just as we do every morning, chant the verse of the case, and we put the okeso or the raksu on our heads, is our tradition, and then we put it on. Maybe he was sitting there, right, with the sangha, and just watching that happen, and as he'd watched it happen day after day, year after year, as he had himself been that person putting on his priest's robe. And maybe he reflected, you know, do these students understand what's happening right at this moment? When we take it up as a koan, it becomes something that we deliberately bring into our meditation. And so the student turns their focus, their power of their concentrated mind, their samadhi, into that question. And so in this, the extraordinary aspect of the koan is it's bringing in the self, it's bringing in the phenomena, the phenomenal world. Here's a question having to do with something that happens. It's bringing in language, words and meaning, all of the stuff in which we need to become very, very clear. We need to examine and become very clear about what is the nature of these things. How do we live in this world freely? And in the commentary, a woman says, now in studying Zen and disciplining ourselves in Zen, one must strictly avoid following sounds and forms, following sounds and clinging to forms. And this is a phrase that's used many times in the teachings. So the Buddha spoke of this thing that we're doing here as a path, Marga, the way. In the West, early on, it was a big hot question when Buddhism was sort of coming into sort of awareness was, is it a religion? Is it not a religion? It's not centered on God, so it's not a religion, but wait a minute. It looks like a religion. What is it? The Buddha said it was a path, a noble path. And that's been spoken of in different ways. Sometimes he said it was the path of the middle way, avoiding self-indulgence on the one side and self-mortification or self-denial on the other. Sometimes he spoke of it as being inclusive. The path is inclusive of the precepts, the teachings of morality and compassion, the calming of the mind, developing samadhi and concentration, and gaining understanding, insight, and realization. In Mahayana Buddhism, the path is the bodhisattva way, the way of realizing self and other as one, of alleviating suffering for self and other. For some, it's been a self-liberation path, wanting to free oneself. It has always been a path that is walked. It is something we do. We are practicing. And that is how we come to be on a path, is by practicing. Right? If we're not practicing, then we're not really on the path in the way that it's understood in Buddhism. But at the same time that we're practicing, because that can seem very much like a means to an end kind of arrangement, we're reminded over and over again that this path is non-dual. That means every step along the way is the very thing. It is being manifested in every step. And all of this is really centered on the question of what is the cause of our suffering? Being human beings, being in this human life, in this human body, why do we universally, generation after generation, apparently since the beginning and perhaps all the way to the end, why are we so adept at creating suffering of all manner? And Buddhism understands suffering in a much, much more broad and profound and subtle way than we would normally think of it. And the Buddha spoke of it that way because he realized it in that profundity, in that subtlety, and also because he realized that it is at all of those levels that we actually are suffering. Which is another way of saying that at the same time that there are lots of ways that we recognize our struggle, there are many ways that we don't, but our struggle nonetheless. And that as we actually become more sensitive, more alive, through practice, then we begin to see those subtle levels that we just pass by, that we just accommodate ourselves to, that we just accept, we become resigned to. In the Lankavatara Sutra, I was studying a passage recently, and the Buddha spoke very nicely about this whole sort of trajectory. He says, in delusion, people let their thoughts wander among the names and appearances of convention to which we become attached. And as we wander among the multitude of these shapes that appear, we fall prey to certain views and longings concerning a self and what belongs to a self. And we become attached to excelling, which is shorthand for gaining and losing, succeeding and failing. And then once we are attached, we become blinded by that very delusion and give rise to passion. Passion here means the entangled thoughts and emotions and beliefs, particularly the emotions, because we're so sort of emotionally based. And so that we give rise to these. And once those become inflamed, and we all know what that's like, once they become inflamed, then the karma that we produce, the actions that come out of our desire and our anger and our delusion, our pride and our jealousy, accumulates. And the Buddha said that the nature of karma is to accumulate. The nature of a desire is to accumulate. It doesn't just think, So you have one cookie. What's next? Right? We know. Right? If one is good, a whole package is going to be great. Right? Desires accumulate. That's their nature. And as it accumulates, they become enveloped. We become enveloped in our own projections, like silkworms in cocoons. It's kind of an interesting image, right? We sort of wrap ourselves in this cocoon that seems to keep us safe. It seems to create a barrier of protection, but actually we become trapped in it. Right? We can't move out, and the world can't actually come in. And because of our delusion, we don't realize that this is happening. We don't see it. It's as though it's invisible. But the Buddha said it's really more likened to an illusion. There is something that's happening, just like a mirage. You see it. You see what appears like water. It certainly looks like water. It absolutely looks like water. But when you get there, you realize there is no water. You saw something. We see something. And if we were all standing there together, we would probably all see it. And so there's something that has this illusory quality, like a mirage, like a reflection of the moon and water. And without a self or what belongs to a self, we see ultimately that this is devoid, empty of any arising or duration or cessation, characteristics, qualities. All are projections of the mind, which is not to say that, kind of from an idealistic view philosophically, that we are somehow creating the world, that nothing actually exists. There is nothing, and we're just making it all up in our mind. That's not what it means. But it means within our awareness, as far as we know anything, we can only know what we perceive. And the Buddha says, and so we wander. And so the Buddha realizes there's essentially a kind of essential or existential misunderstanding, a misinterpretation in our everyday ordinary perceptions that we rely almost exclusively on, and I underline almost, to tell us what the world is and how to be in it. And who you are and who I am and what all of this is about. And so when we hear a sound, it seems obvious that the sound is out there. Someone strikes the bell. I can see Rebecca at the bell, striking it. And the sound emanates. It's clear that it is out there. That there's something that's out there and my ear just happens to pick it up. That sound exists on its own. Independently of me. That sound is freestanding, self-existing. That's the basic understanding of delusion or from delusion. We just hear what is out there objectively and just arrives on our doorstep. We have nothing really to do with it other than just to receive the message. We don't realize we are the message. And so when Wu Men says to avoid following sounds and clinging to forms, in a sense, all of suffering and all of our liberation is in those simple words. And we might wonder, you know, Buddhism being a path that is very much based in hearing the teachings, reflecting, and then practicing them, actually practicing the teachings, right? If we want to find out if they're true, we have to embody what they're pointing at, where we have to actually go to the place that they're describing and see what happens. And so if delusion was true, was an accurate depiction or presentation of what is actually going on, then given that the world is deluded and we in it, then why is there so much conflict and disagreement? If we agree that life is so dear, then why do we destroy it so much? If as a practitioner of the Bodhisattva path, who also happens to be a white person, in a country with 400 years of violence based on an illusion of race. And I recognize that, and I want to free myself and others of that, then why do I continue to speak out of that place of racialized blindness? Why can't we just change ourselves? Why can't we just be that enlightened being? Isn't that very question based on the notion that there is something that once we discover, oh, it must be flawed, okay, so then how do I just fix it? That's just the same old system. I've been reading a book by Kathy Park Hong, who's a Korean-American poet and writer. Her book, Minor Feelings, an Asian-American Reckoning. And in that, it was kind of an extraordinary book, I think. But in that, she talks about 2016 and with the killings of Michael Brown and George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and just the massive happening and awareness and display and response to these 400 years of racialized violence. She says, for many white Americans, if they hadn't before, they now felt marked for their skin color, and their reaction for being exposed as such was to feel shame. And then she talks about shame as an inward, intolerable feeling, but it can lead to productive outcomes because of the self-scrutiny that shame requires, which is very similar to how Buddhism understands it. Shame is in a way, a natural response of our compassion to something that we have done or we've been participating in that we recognize has been intolerable, untenable, unacceptable, painful. And that the intolerability of that emotion of shame demands our attention, demands self-awareness and self-scrutiny. What is going on? What am I doing? What is this? And she says, but while shame can lead to productive self-scrutiny, it can also lead to contempt. And she talks about how it can be used, that shame can be used to sort of turn the attention towards others. She says, suddenly Americans, some folks who are white-skinned, feel self-conscious of their white identity, and this very self-consciousness misleads them, deludes them, into thinking their identity itself is under threat, that there is something inherently wrong with the color of our skin, the color of my skin as a white person. This is the arising of the self. This is the projection of the self. That as we continue to live and experience things anew, experience new things, learn new things, sort of have new things revealed to us, just as when we practice our own sort of personal delusion, if you will, that the self appropriates that. It grabs onto that because that's what the self does. And it uses that both to, if it perceives it as a threat, to defend, or if there's enough compassion or bodhicitta to actually want to take it up and take responsibility for it, then that shame arises, and that shame then transforms into a sense that there is something inherently wrong with me, right? Which is the self, reifying, objectifying, solidifying. She says, in being asked to be made aware of racial oppression, I, as a white person myself, feel oppressed. So look at that subtle illusory shift. That a moment before, the pain that led to my shame was my part and white Americans' part in the creation and the perpetuation of this violence, which I now realize I am a part of. But in that sense of being wronged, of now I am the oppressed one, that very deftly moves the attention away from myself and onto others. Black, brown, Asian Americans. Why? So that I can resume my place so that I can maintain that sense of my own being and not be threatened. She talks about the sense of white tears. She says, she quotes an author, Damon Young, who says that they can sometimes seem, you know, appear as, she says, while we laugh at white tears, I think she's probably speaking from perspective of BIPOC, she says they can be dangerous. White tears is why defeated Southerners refused to accept the freedom of black slaves and form the Ku Klux Klan. White tears are why 63% of white men and 53% of white women elected a malignant man-child as their leader. For to be aware of history, I as a white person, would be forced to be held accountable. And rather than face that shame, we would rather, by any means necessary, maintain my innocence, maintain this sense of who I am. It's a reaction. It's a reflexive action. If I'm not aware, it's what just seems to naturally happen. And that's the cycle we're trying to interrupt. That's exactly the point we're trying to enter into before that illusion of something that is false gets recast as something new that is false, so that I effectively don't have to do anything. I don't have to change. I don't have to examine. I don't have to be uncomfortable. I don't have to be accountable. Right? It's like that essential human inclination towards comfort at any cost, even when it's not actually comfort. It's an illusion of comfort. And so what are the views and longings concerning a self and what belongs to a self, and how we become attached to excelling, to gaining and losing, to not failing? My whiteness, my benefits, white solidarity, lack of moral responsibility, and how this gives rise to passions, right? The subtitle of Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, says, why is it so difficult for white people to talk about race? Simple question. Just a simple question. Why is it so hard? And why, in doing that, does it give rise to passions, strong emotions that become inflamed, and through from within which we create karma, and we become enveloped further in our projections? And so we're back again to Wu Men's avoid following sounds and clinging to forms. Study this illusory self. And so Master Yunmen takes it up in a simple moment. Look, this world is vast and wide, boundless, without any boundary. Why, at the sound of the bell, do you put on your robe? If this world is vast and wide, which is what every Buddhist teacher, every Buddhist enlightened being, and any other person who has touched the ground of being has realized, if it's so vast and wide, why are we so passionate and proficient in making it so confined and narrow and painful? To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, to forget the ideas, the beliefs, the grasping, the illusion. To realize we don't have to break out of this cocoon, we just have to realize there is actually no cocoon. The cocoon itself is such is an illusion, which is why we have to keep building it, right? I mean, if it was a real thing, you build it once, it's done. But that's not actually what we see. We realize we're actually in a continual state of building and rebuilding. And when that gets threatened or challenged, we have to fortify. To forget the self is to freely release that sense of grasping. And we realize if we don't examine, if we don't practice, we will be so strongly inclined to stay in that cocoon. And so think of just beginning Zazen. You sit quite simply, quite sincerely, quite innocently, not knowing the whole world is appearing on your doorstep. The world of the self, the world of others, the world of things, the world of past. All of the worlds that you love and want to cherish, and you see them crumbling in front of you, and all the worlds that you thought your meditation was going to protect you from. And now we have the opportunity to actually illuminate. Enlightenment is to illuminate, to cast light on. One day, Yunmen was giving a talk, and he struck the kutz on his seat, and he said, "Every sound is the voice of the Buddha, and every form is the Buddha's shape. Yet, when you hold your bowl and eat your food, you create a bowl view. When you walk, you hold a walking view. When you sit, you create a sitting view. The whole world turns and turns in this way. There is just the bowl. There is just this moment. There is just walking. But we create a view, a world, an idea, a belief system, opinions. But all the while, the food, the bowl, the walking, the sitting are empty of any inherent characteristic. Free of any constraint, any conflict, any boundary, they appear in one moment and they depart. That's their nature. The Buddha said they are to be experienced. Allow ourselves that, to just experience. He said they do not belong to you, and you will know that the moment you try to possess them. And they defy that. They do not allow you to possess them because that is not their nature. And when we experience that which is free of constraint and conflict and boundary from within that cocoon of constraint and conflict and boundary, we shouldn't be surprised that our experience of our world is bound and conflicted and constrained. In a sense, our suffering is the evidence of our suffering, which would be just circular, that's the spinning of samsara, until we begin to question. And then it becomes a path. Every morning, the densho sounds, and we put on our robe. Every morning, the alarm rings and people get out of bed. The phone rings and you answer it. The doorbell rings and you go to the door. Why? Yunmen asks. Sometimes why is just a question that leads to more and more cocoon building. The reasons, the explanations, the definitions, the rationale. And we can find that very comforting, but it doesn't actually help. This why that Yunmen is asking is to essentially split your head open in the best possible way. It's not a philosophical question, not even a little bit. This wondrous life, each day, preparing meals, washing dishes, going to work, being with friends and family. Why? And of course, there are books and books and books and philosophies and ideologies to explain. But having the answer, does that satisfy anyone's heart? Does it bring peace in the midst of this very life? Does it provide refuge in times of distress? Does it help us to understand why the house is on fire? Within this sea of impermanence, what is the point of it all? Some of you asked that very question this weekend. What's the point? It doesn't take much examination to feel like it's pointless, it's meaningless. Why even continue? And in those moments, check your mind, because it's moving fast. It's got strands of silk and it's building a cocoon. Is that the correct question? What is the point? Is there something beyond having a point? Is there a kind of meaning that can't be spoken? Dogen says, undivided activity, in his fascicle, undivided activity, he says, emancipation means that in birth, you're emancipated from birth. In death, you're emancipated from death. There's freedom in birth and death. There's examination of birth and death. There's passage through birth and death. This is the complete practice of the way. This very activity makes birth completely birth, makes death wholly death. I think this is what Master Yunmen was saying. In this complete activity of this holding, this bowl, there is emancipation when it is wholly the bowl, when it is wholly walking, when it is wholly sitting. And that is the sharp point of our practice, how to enter into that one moment of undivided, holy this. Holy here means whole, W-H-O-L-E. And it actualized at just that moment, Dogen says, it's not large or small. It's not measurable or immeasurable. It is not comparable to anything. As Dada Roshi used to often say, it is not like anything. Thus, it is emancipated. Thus, it is vast and wide. And thus, Yunmen asks this penetrating question, why? And so, Wu Men says, though it may be so, you tell me, does the sound come to your ear? Does your ear go to the sound? He's really asking us to take up the most simplest of things, the most simplest of experiences. We have how many times a day? A sound, a sight. But now to ask a penetrating question, what is this experience? Does it happen in the bell? Does it happen in my ear? And why is that even important? When I follow that into the very source of that and discover this experience, that holy sound, nothing but the sound of the bell, Master Yunmen is saying, now you will understand why you put on your robe at the sound of the bell. Now you will understand why you pick up the phone. And it's not an answer. It's not something that has meaning. It is the living experience of a life holy, consummated in that one moment. Here, there is no doubt. There is no distress. When he says, if you listen with your ear, you cannot truly get it. You have to hear with your eye. I remember when I would listen to Dada Roshi say that, and I would think, what are you talking about? Like, I know it's not literal, but come on. It's like, I don't even know where to start with that. Exactly. Maybe you start with nothing. There is no place to start with that. Maybe you just start with the bell sound. But to think about it, when you read or watch the news with your eyes, a country bombing another country, one group shouting at another group, one person hating another person. Why, when you're reading that with your eyes, or seeing the images with your eyes, does your skin crawl? Does your stomach contract? Does your mouth taste like metal? Or does your blood get hot? Or do your bones get weary? Or why does everything go cold and silent? Why is there suddenly a veil of distance? You're just seeing something with your eyes. Or are you? So in Wu Men, who's quoting Master Dongshan, says you can only if you hear it with your eye. Isn't that happening all the time? Undivided means you yourself are vast and wide. And so when you sit focusing on your breath to experience your breath as vast and wide, the breath itself, you yourself as vast and wide, to be emancipated in that moment of the breath, of one moment of awareness, of one moment of the koan, where it is wholly breath, wholly awareness. Delusion is the cocoon building is almost ceaseless, dividing. I mean, how long have we been fighting each other? I would venture to say exactly as long as we've been fighting ourselves, exactly that amount of time. Creating illusions of boundary, of inside and outside, of skin, of gender, of sexuality, of faith, of beliefs, all the while obscuring the beautiful, abundant truth of this world, of all of these creatures. How long have we been pouring our vital energies into fortifying and justifying and defending those illusory boundaries? Even in the peace talks, like this big meeting that happened in Europe, the G7, right? How hard it is, even in trying to talk about how we can live together and not have self-interests constantly be preventing our ability to do that. That is in everyone's interests equally, the self-interest. And yet the Buddha said, but you can't deny the self. Okay, so don't, he said. Don't deny it. In fact, don't deny any interest. Know how to hold them all. Which seems impossible until we realize how vast and wide the world is. And we are. And a thought is, and a possibility is. If you understand it, all things are one. If you do not, they're different and separate. This poem is a beautiful example of a koan, of using language, which seems like, okay, words mean this. If you understand, it means this. And Wu Men is making it very clear, well, what else does it mean? When nothing is fixed, when words themselves are vast and wide, as Dogen says, when ordinary language is the 10 directions, then we can be used freely to show all kinds of perspectives and sides and awaken us. If you understand it, all things are one, but if you don't, they're different and separate. You know, it's like believing in unity. I believe we're all one until the moment you cut me off in traffic, and then we are not one, right? We got a problem, and I'm letting you know about it. That's why beliefs are not enough. That's why faith alone is not enough. And so we have to study, we have to reflect, we have to examine, we have to actually put it into practice. We have to enlighten and illuminate ourselves from the inside out and from the outside in. Essentially, every which way. If you do not understand it, all things are one. If you do, they're different and separate. If you do not understand, Yunmen's why do you put on your robe at the sound of the bell is trying to free us from the confinement of knowing about everything. And so as Zazen, we're constantly encountering that mind that is trying to struggle continuously to know, to locate, to position, to fortify, and to relax, to release, to let go. so we can live free within this very world. You know, because the Buddha was so clear about his own path, seeing that everywhere he looked, he saw in the human realm creating unnecessary suffering, and then realizing the fundamental basis. Having seen that so clearly, he realized that that is us, and that we are very godlike in our human consciousness. We create worlds and we destroy them. And that the power of an intention, of a desire, of a sense of something even before it's clear, the sense of a possibility, the sense of another way. And it's like within his enlightenment, he realized the full potential of that incipient seed that I think exists within all of us. And then he said, here's a way to develop that, to nurture that, just like a garden. And so my wish is that all of us, you know, I mentioned during the weekend that, you know, Buddhism is not a proselytizing kind of venture. It just kind of lays it out for us to see. You know, this is pretty much what's going on here. Check it out. I mean, really, that's kind of what it's saying. Check it out, right? If you care. If you care, check it out and see. And that the more we do that, I think it is essentially inevitable that we will meet an imperative. Right? Rather than life becoming purposeless or meaningless, we realize, no, actually everything matters so much more than we ever knew or imagined, and perhaps we're even afraid to imagine, because now what? If we allowed ourselves to actually make contact with how important this world is and life is, then we would know that somehow we are part of that. We are implicated, right? And that just seems too overwhelming. And yeah, pretty much. There are certainly lots of moments it seems overwhelming. But those moments are always when we're standing back and measuring and comparing. And so the Buddha Dharma is really just an invitation. Just step forward. Step in. Check it out. So I'll end with a poem. And I really want to encourage, particularly those of you here for the weekend, to continue, however your path might unfold, which, of course, you can't know yet. That's the deal. You got to walk it to find out. If you want to find out, you have to take a step. I'll end with a poem. Every inhalation this breath fills, every footfall this earth secures, every looking up this sky covers, every moistened cheek this ocean encompasses. What shall I call your cloud body? Where will you meet this one fleeting life? Maybe that's the question we were born into. How will we meet this one fleeting life? Not meeting it is not an option. So may we meet it within our true nature, within all the whole of what we are as Buddhas.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.